I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. I'm Kevin Middleton. I'm here in the studio with Samantha Berg. And today we're going to be interviewing Dr. Joe Brenner. He's a physical therapist, and his practice is called Infinity Physical Therapy, and I just love that name. And we're going to get into his unique approach to physical therapy. He's a bit of a legend in our community. We've been here practicing for about 8 years, and we just have so many patients that we've heard very positive feedback. He just does extraordinary work, and so we want to get a little bit of an insight into what he does, how he does it, and hopefully you'll learn along with us today too. And before we get into the interview, I just wanted to just invite you to go to Facebook and find us on Facebook, Bridge to Everywhere, and like us, and you'll get notice of all the events that are coming up and follow-up information for the guests on our show.
Great. So I'd like to introduce Dr. Joe Brenner to everyone. Dr. Brenner has a bachelor's, a master's, and a doctorate degree in physical therapy. He's a specialist with strain, counterstrain, myofascial release, and craniosacral manual therapies. He's been a past decades practitioner of Tai Chi Chuan, and he's had some trainings in the Alexander Technique with deceased master Marjorie Barstow and other senior Alexander Technique senior teachers. And he's also got a 40-year history of weight training and conditioning. So welcome to the show, Joe.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. So what we'd like to do is kind of get a little bit of a sense of your background, kind of flesh out some of the things that I mentioned in your little mini bio that I went over. And then we want to talk about how what you do is different from what other physical therapists do, some of the ways that it's the same and some of the ways it's different. Mm-hmm. So what someone would experience when they come in your office.
Okay.
So, but first off, we'd just like to get a sense of, you know, how did you decide to become a physical therapist? What had you end up doing this career?
Yeah, and you've brought in so many different modalities and approaches to your work. And just curious how you created this unique synthesis of modalities.
Well, I ended up going back to school, PT school, late. I was 38, 39 years old. I worked as a counselor and became burnt out in that field. And so physical therapy, I was renting our condo to two PT students, and it just dawned on me what a perfect fit for me for the different experiences in life I've had. So going back to school late was it was good timing, because I was mature enough to understand that's what I really wanted to do in life. And so it's my life's work, it's my passion now.
So, and how long does it take to get a physical therapy degree? You have to have an undergrad degree, correct, first or not?
Yeah, well, it's different now. You have to have a 4-year degree in a related field, then they go 3 years for a doctorate. It's changed over. When I went to school, you had to go 4 years for a bachelor's degree in physical therapy, then another year for a master's, and another year for a doctorate. So I've had 6 years of PT school.
And how long have you been practicing in Palmer?
With my clinic, approximately 9 years. But I worked at the Old Valley Hospital and different areas around the valley. So I've been a PT. How long has it been? 12, 13 years?
Mm-hmm. It's been a while. So, and what's interesting, it seems like with the physical therapy degree, is that a lot of people take that degree and you can incorporate many different modalities underneath that degree. So once you have the basic PT degree, I think what the assumption I think a lot of people make is that physical therapy is about recovering from surgery. You know, like maybe I'm recovering from an accident. I have an injury and I need to get exercises to get back into shape. But that's really not what you do. You do a manual physical therapy practice. So we kind of want to pull apart what's the difference between a manual physical therapy and other types of physical therapy practices.
Yeah, and along with that, you will address that kind of injury. You know, an automobile, recovering from an injury, traumatic injury, just using a different approach, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the beauty of the physical therapy field. You can be, do pediatrics to geriatrics to wide-ranging. But for me, it just dawned on me that I had a gift with my hands, so I started taking lots of manual therapy courses, and that's from then on I just took off with the manual therapy classes and daily 8 hours a day doing manual therapies on people. But I always could fall back on regular, normal, what I would call normal physical therapy with movements. And so years passed also with posture re-education with the Alexander technique, being able to identify and see people, kind of how they're holding tension and or how they may be holding myofascial restrictions. And so actually doing an evaluation, what I call a parking lot test, when somebody's coming for an initial evaluation, I actually sometimes can see them walk in the parking lot, and I'm observing how they go upstairs, how they're walking, how they're holding themselves, and it gives a lot of information. So you can come to physical therapy for multiple dimensions, posture to hands-on healing manual therapies, and then get them moving in a different way. Because if they're moving in a certain pattern that's dysfunctional, I can do releases. If they go back to that same pattern, then the releases will probably not hold, and they'll come back to pain patterns.
And when you say releases, what does that mean?
Yeah, that's a good question. It is kind of hard to describe, but the fascia is a covering. It's a matrix throughout the whole body. If you can visualize a fabric on a table, and if you twist it in a certain area, it starts to become tighter and has folds in it. That's kind of how our body is. They hold myofascial restrictions and become stuck. So what I do is unwind areas of the body, and it frees up that muscle structure or vascular or neurologic information that's being impinged upon. So our release, well, from a strain counterstrain standpoint with Dr. Jones, he had specific tender points throughout the whole body, exquisite tender points, not trigger points, tender. They're so precise and tender. When a release happens, a muscle structure is bound up and is tight, and it's shortened in a shortened range. When it's released, the pain goes away because the free nerve endings were hypervigilant because of all the restriction around there. So when it releases, it actually releases the fascia in the muscle where it can move naturally and normally, and the length-tension ratio of that muscle is on slack where it should be.
Okay.
So people get bound up, and they're restricted, so a release frees them up to move in a normal way.
Now, how does lactic acid building up in the muscles play into this? Sometimes I'm thinking about muscle spasms just because a muscle's being fatigued. Maybe there's a compensation happening from an injury, and a muscle's being used in a way that is not designed to be used as a compensation. Eventually, that just becomes spasming. The whole system is weak, and is that fitting into with that, or is that addressed differently?
I think a lot of times spasming has to do with the restriction again. The neurologic system is being impinged upon, and that the information is not getting to the neuromuscular system, and so it's almost like electric charge it's being shorted. So a lot of times that's what I see with a spastic situation or somebody who is excessively tight.
Okay. So I want to go back and just start. So you're talking about dysfunctional holding patterns versus functional patterns. Could you draw that out a little bit? Like, what would that mean? Like, if you were going to evaluate someone as they're walking through the parking lot, what would you be looking at as they walk in?
Well, and with today's society, a classic pattern is computer work with a forward head posture, rounded shoulders, and as we get more and more tired, we almost fold out driving a car. We're front beings. We're anterior beings. We start to be almost drawn. And so when you have a rounded shoulder posture or forward head and watching someone walk in, they've almost turned that pattern into their body, into their life. And so I can see that in them, that what we need to change. And so the patterning is especially, again, with computer work and certain jobs that are sitting, it starts to shape your body, and things become dysfunctional in terms of like the pectoralis. A muscle in front in the pec region will become shortened, and there's a big nerve bundle that goes through there. People start having symptoms in their hands. a lot of times it's simple posture changing, but people have to want to change.
So this would be, you know, the person working on the computer sometimes would get diagnosed with carpal tunnel, you know, and would be have surgery recommended to them, but you're saying it could actually be just the pectoralis muscle is tight and that's why they're having problems with their hands, so maybe they're not, maybe it's not carpal tunnel. Maybe if they change their posture, change their exercise, change the way their, you know, their work environment is, they could actually fix that.
That's correct, but some people are that way, and that you can actually do a nerve conduction velocity test on the median nerve, and it'll show up there's a problem. So they immediately do surgery when, instead of addressing the origin of the problem, sometimes, like meat cutters and people do have true carpal tunnel, and they have to have surgery.
And what is true carpal tunnel? Just so I would love to just get a definition of it, because we have so many people who come in who are told that they have carpal tunnel. And in my experience, like what you were talking about, there's often something going on in the neck. There's an impingement in the neck and shoulders that the pectoralis muscle actually didn't think about, although we can see that when people are kind of collapsed forward. But just if you could give us a definition, what would be the true medical definition of somebody who's really got carpal tunnel? And what does that mean?
There's in the tunnel by your wrist, there's 8 tendons and 1 nerve, the median nerve, and it's only the median nerve. It's going to be hard to describe on radio, but there's 2.5 muscles from a motor standpoint that run the median nerve runs. And also you oppose, the small finger and the thumb oppose one another. And if they are extremely weak, and if they have numbness from a sensory standpoint at the tips of their finger, and the 2.5 muscle groups that I'm talking about are extremely weak, that is true carpal tunnel. And I get people coming to me like you that they said I have carpal tunnel, and it's very specific, and I'm surprised at the misdiagnosis a lot of times. But anyways, I would rather have from a manual therapy standpoint, have somebody work on me. Why not try to free it up out of your neck or shoulders? What if it is? And or even down in the carpal region, I do manual therapies down there too. So I would, for me personally, rather go a manual therapy route if I was a patient, and at least attempt that at first.
It always seems to me to do the least invasive thing first, you know, to do some sessions with a manual therapist or acupuncture or massage, do something and see what kind of results you can get. You can always do surgery in the end, but once you've done surgery, you can't really go back. That's what it's, you know, once you've already gotten in there and changed structure, you can't really fix that. So it seems like it's worth it to try to do something else to see if you can get some movement through there.
That's correct. I mean, surgery, when needed, is fantastic stuff. But when you scalpel in the body, it's somewhat of an insult. And adhesions can build up in the carpal tunnel region, so people have 1 or 2 or 3 surgery releases and then it keeps coming back. And actually, sometimes it'll get worse because of the adhesion buildups. So, yeah, it makes sense just to go the least invasive first, and then if needed, that's fine. There's some fantastic surgeons out there who do wonderful work, too.
And adhesions are scar tissue, correct?
Yeah, thank
you. So that's that scar tissue that forms around the nerve after the surgery?
That's correct. Yep.
And when you're talking, one of the terms that you brought up earlier was impingement. So you're talking about a nerve that is impinged in tissue, or is that specifically refer to like bone on bone? When you say an impingement or an entrapment, what are you?
Or is it even just inflammation of soft tissue around the nerve?
You're right, Kevin, but it becomes an impingement because that tunnel is a cartilage. It can only hold so much of mass. And if there's a swelling to that tunnel, pregnant women will have transient carpal tunnel symptoms because they swell and they have true carpal tunnel, but it's temporary. And it gets a little more complicated because from a visceral standpoint or a differential diagnosis, which is how different organs in the body affect nerves that affect the hand, people come to me, in fact, my last patient, who has symptoms in her hand, and it can become from your gallbladder and liver. It's evidence-based medicine, how it affects certain nerves that go into your armpit, and people have symptoms in their hand and actually can be carpal tunnel-like.
And would that dysfunction in the liver or gallbladder be inflammation in those tissues that are affecting that nerve pathway? Is it a deeper functional imbalance in the organ?
Yes. Sometimes it's nutrition, but sometimes what I've found, and I can't verify this, but viral. We're in contact with a lot of bacteria and virus in our world. And I have seen, in fact, the person that I said, you have your liver is clogged, we'll call it. There's something going on with your liver. She went back to her hand surgeon who said, well, go back to your general physician because it's been shown that you have some viral infection in your liver. And I was working on, she came to me with a hand problem. So sometimes, well, it can get dimensional and deeper. Sometimes it is pure carpal tunnel, and that's what a good physical therapist does, is evaluate and treat where is this coming from and on what level. And what area?
From a Chinese medical perspective, it's interesting that you're saying that because we have this concept of what's called latent pathogens in the liver and gallbladder. So the person may have gotten some kind of virus, and now it's living in that area of the body. But in Chinese medicine, the liver and the gallbladder are actually responsible for the health of the muscles and the joints and the tendons. The way that Chinese medicine sees it is actually getting the blood flow and the nourishment and moistening out to all the joints and tendons. Mm-hmm. So if you have some sort of basically we call it lack of smooth flow of qi or energy going through the gallbladder or the liver, you're going to have joint and tendon and muscle issues. So, you know, what you're observing and describing from more of a Western medical standpoint, the Chinese have a way of describing it completely makes sense to us. Mm-hmm. That kind of pattern could come from a liver and gallbladder issue.
Yeah, and as we're talking about this, it's starting to really fill out a holistic worldview, a holistic perspective where you can kind of see where various worldviews, various insights into the human body, you can create a very nuanced differential diagnosis and treatment plan.
And we also don't want to be knocking surgery, but I mean our goal is always to get to the underlying issue, like what is causing the problem in the first place. So going back to the carpal tunnel situation, it seems like if we don't address why the carpal tunnel showed up in the first place and you just treat the symptom where it's showing up, then like what you said, it can, you know, the person might end up with multiple surgeries because you're not going back and looking at where did this thing start. So we want to go back to the place where this thing started and change that pattern, and then hopefully the symptom is going to resolve.
Beyond carpal tunnel, I've seen this multiple times. I have people that come in, had no neck problem. They woke up, they have what's called torticollis or a wry neck, stiff neck, and they can't turn their head. And they said, I didn't do anything.
Yeah, what is that?
I've experienced that myself.
Uh-huh. And my question was to them, were you sick about 2 weeks ago? Mm-hmm. And I don't know what percentage, it's a high percentage. They say, yes, I was sick. How did you know that? And I said, well, I really didn't know that, but that's my intuition that. And so virus, especially the certain muscles in the neck, there's main ones, the sternocleidomastoid and the upper trapezius, they're dually innervated. The only two muscles in the body by the brain nerves, cranial nerves, and the peripheral nerves. And so those seem to get attacked, but with viruses very easily. And they make almost like, well, it's kind of like a small form of tetany in a way. So that's what I've observed quite a bit. So, and I can't put a finger on this viral thing, but I seem to see it a lot.
What would be your treatment for that?
Yeah. The manual therapy is directly, exactly to the areas they're having a problem and get them moving to that release situation, free up their neck, free up the muscles, because it's stuck. I see the body as a pulley system, one side and the other. There's got to be symmetry. And so if the pulley systems are tight on one side and lax on the other, you have to free it up where the muscle can elongate and they can begin to move freely. Mm-hmm. So that's I do a lot of manual therapies. Then people are locked into a psychophysical mechanism where they got used to having a wry neck or a stiff neck or whatever it is, and they're almost afraid to move because it was painful. And I'll get them moving through Feldenkrais patterns or different human movement patterns, and they don't realize that they're moving a certain way, and next thing you know, oh, I can move my neck now. So sometimes you don't have to trick them to get past their brain that they can move in a more natural way. And that stuff can be cleared up actually pretty quick.
Now, you've mentioned Alexander technique and now also Feldenkrais as a couple of different modalities that have informed your work. Can you say a little bit more about them and their movement therapies, as I understand it?
And what's the difference between the two, and why would somebody seek out one or the other, or are they complementary?
Feldenkrais, Moshe Feldenkrais was a physicist who was actually a student of F.M. Alexander's, and he got kicked out of Alexander's school. So he started to do, because he's a physicist, he's watching human beings move, and he developed functional patterns. Again, I come back to symmetry in the body, created symmetry. And people start to move, and the more you do it, there's a psychophysical mechanism that kicks in. F.M. Alexander was somewhat of a genius in terms of, in the late 1800s, he discovered that he was a singer, and he was throwing his head back and discovered that actually by moving forward and up, he was able to free up his throat and not have these problems, and he started looking into human movement. So the more subtle and gentle we can be with our upright posture, the more mechanisms and systems in the body can move naturally and normally.
It's great. My posture just improved about 100%.
Yeah, everybody's
sitting up a lot.
Very aware of how we're sitting right now. So, and then Alexander technique is different in what way?
It's a very, very subtle, gentle hands-on. The way Marjorie Barstow did it was like myofascial release with movement. I almost have to put my hands on myself to remind me. And she gets you moving in a different way, and you get a different sensory appreciation of what it feels like to be forward and up and moving freely. And it's an imprint in your brain, in your body, that, oh, that's freedom of movement. And so the trick is to keep thinking and capturing that as we go along. But we also get tired throughout the day, and we start sitting a little more slumped or this or that. And Marjorie always talked about, that's fine, you can slump. In fact, even slump even more. And then build yourself back up and start to move. So, you know, we're not perfect human beings. We're going to fall short of fall asleep to ideas. But the thing is, once you notice that you're almost beginning to hurt or your muscle structure, then you can move upward. And so it's a tool to help you function in life in a more freed up fashion.
And when you're working with folks, are you giving them exercises that they then take on themselves? And does that help the manual therapy work you do hold? Is that like an essential part of the results you're getting?
Exactly. And that's why I insist on, I have too many patients. I want to get people better as best I can, as fast as I can, and actually make them responsible for their situation. And once they realize, oh, I can move in a different way, and I will tell them that they're married to some of these patterns and strengthening stability exercise that I've given them, and that's the magic. You don't need me anymore. You can do these things, and you're freed up. And I will have people call in my front desk. Person, she'll say, "Oh, you've been doing your home exercise." I haven't seen somebody in like a year. I'm having a problem again, and she'll ask, "Have you been doing your home exercise program?" Well, no. I was feeling so good that I stopped doing it. And so, anyway, we kind of fall back on patterns. The thing is, jump back on the train, and just get back towards health.
So in what you're describing, I'm seeing a lot. The brain seems to come up fairly frequently. So we're talking not only in just human patterns and ways that we get stuck. You know, we go back to old habits. When things are doing well, we forget to do our exercises, or we forget to do the things that we were doing to keep ourselves well. And sooner or later, we stop feeling that good, and then there's a problem. But then you're also talking about it. I think there's another misconception I see, which is like, it's just my knee, just fix it. You know, it's just my elbow, it's just my shoulder, it's just my neck. But there's like, it's everything's interconnected, so you can't really look at these parts as individual parts. They're all connected to a system, which is connected to a central nervous system. So you have to look at the body from that perspective, and not just like, you know, the knee did not walk in your office on its own, right? So you can't just treat the knee in isolation.
Exactly right. I mean, I could start at the knee, but you have hip pain. Well, yeah, actually, I do have a little hip pain. How's your back doing? Well, I've been sore. I don't know why. The nerve roots that run the knee come out kind of your lumbar spine, and can be affected by the sacral nerve roots too. But anyways, it's obvious to me. It's all how could it not be connected? Mike, that's the first thing in anatomy classes. What are the muscle attachments and insertions, and what nerves run that? So you got to go back to the full system. Then you fix their back, hip. Oh, my knee feels better all of a sudden. Also, or you have to look at their gait pattern. It gets a little complicated. Are they walking a certain way and collapsing their plantar fascia that creates the knee problem, or is it coming from higher up, down low? So again, just what you're talking about, holistic, you have to look at the whole person in the body and observe. And here's the one thing that I do, is listen to people. I actually fix people through listening to their feedback. They tell me the answers, how to fix them by, and they say, why should be an ex-counselor? But beyond that, it's like, I like to listen. It's like, what happened after I treated you? And they tell me things, and I think about it. It's like, oh, that's okay. I know where I'm going next. So, and I tell them, we're together as a team. We're treating each other. I'm treating you, but we're going to help get you better together. And that's how it should be. And then people feel better about the ownership of that.
Yeah, yeah. And I love what you're saying because it does create this partnership. They don't feel like they're in it alone, but you're making them also fully responsible for taking on their part that's theirs to take on. And it actually becomes a fun process of discovery for patients when they really start to pay attention to their bodies and they start to see the results associated with their own efforts.
Well, that's why one of the reasons I purchased an older home in Palmer and made it very comfortable. I wanted a setting where people came in and felt comfortable and really, in a certain way, develop a relationship with my patients. I mean, we have fun during the day and one-on-one and that watch them get better. And it's just, it's a relationship versus a doctor-patient kind of situation. No, we're together fixing the person.
And it's not only a relationship, though, but it's also, I think, people leave your office and it seems like they have a sense of what's possible. You know, like they learn about, they may have thought that they came in with some limits and they're leaving your office and they're actually seeing possibility again, where they've been told, well, this isn't going to get better. We can't go any further with this. And you're actually, I mean, I love it when people are told, well, you're not going to be able to, this is it. This is as far as we know, you're not going to get any better. And then they go and they work with a physical therapist and all of a sudden, you know, everything opens up and things that they thought they'd never be able to do again, they're able to do.
The one small criticism I have with my field that I'm in, regular medicine, is I get people come to me and doctors seem to be very limiting and negative with their, they have to watch their words, they're very powerful, mm-hmm. the words. Mm-hmm. And so when I come to people, I'm not going to tell them the truth, but if somebody, just one of your patients came to me with a shoulder issue and I could see there wasn't a true biomechanical issue, she was going to get better. And that alone just brings optimism and a healing to that person where they're smiling and feeling, even though I maybe didn't even treat them, I can see that they can get better, and they're happy for that.
Yeah, just the confidence. Yeah, just mm-hmm. seeing that confidence that this is absolutely something they can change.
Yeah, there's two effects going here. There's the placebo effect and the nocebo effect. And both of them are documented. They're real things. I mean, nobody really truly understands them, but we know that if the practitioner is positive and encouraging and believes that the person can get better, there's potentially one outcome. And there's been research that shows when people have been improperly diagnosed, you know, misdiagnosed, have been told that they're going to die, and it turns out that the person didn't actually have what they were diagnosed with, that in some cases the patients fulfilled what the doctor said.
Mm.
So you can convince someone that they're going to get better and they get better, and you can also convince somebody that they're not going to get better and they don't get better. So, I mean, from my standpoint, it always seems like, why not hold out for some hope that there's possibility there, like come from that standpoint, you know. And within, I wonder if in the effort not to give people false hope in our medical system, that people are erring on the side of, you know, saying, well, I just want to make sure this person knows all the possible downsides or all the negatives, so I've got it, you know, I've covered my bases. But I don't know that that's serving the patient.
On that note, we're going to wrap up here for just a moment, take a break, and we'll be back with Dr. Joe Brenner from Infinity Physical Practice, Physical Therapy.
You're listening to Radio Free Palmer, KVRF 89.5 on your FM dial. If you'd like to get involved with Radio Free Palmer, contact us at radiofreepalmer.org. This is your chance to invent community radio in Sutton, Butte, Chickaloon, and the surrounding areas.
Welcome back to The Bridge to Everywhere. We're speaking with Dr. Joe Brenner And he's an innovative physical therapist. He has a unique synthesis of modalities he brings into his work here in Palmer. And before we get back into our dialogue, I wanted to invite you to become a member of KVRF Radio Free Palmer. You can do that by going to the website, radiofreepalmer.org, and look at their different membership levels. They don't cost much, and it sure is appreciated. It makes this kind of programming available.
And?
It's fun.
It's fun.
It's fun to be a member. It's fun to make this kind of content available, not just to the local population, but also to the world. And that's one of the reasons we made this show, is because there's this amazing time in history we live in where all the world's knowledge is available a keystroke away. And we believe, and this is really true, that all the innovators in the world are one keystroke and one radio station away, and Radio Free Palmer is making that possible. So we're bringing Joe Brenner to the world, and we're going to bring the world into Palmer. And that's what our program is all about.
So that's global is the new local?
That's right. That's
global
right.
is the new local.
Local and global are not two, one thing.
Okay, so we want to get back to our interview with Joe, and we want to just talk about possibilities. So if you've got some case studies that you can talk about, some obviously we want to keep things confidential, so not mention specific names, but anything from your experience over the past 10 or 12 years where you were even surprised where the kind of success that people have, where you maybe didn't think that it was possible for them to heal the way they did, and they were able to.
Well, recently I had a woman come to me that had her blood pressure was spiking for no reason, and her heart, atrial fibrillation, her heart had irregular beats, and I did manual therapies on her heart region and the right left upper quadrant and into her neck, and I just wanted to calm things down. She's actually going to go for a stress test right after I treated her, and by the time she got to do the stress test, she had normalized, and the stress test, they couldn't replicate her symptoms, and she hasn't had them since. Now, I'm not saying I can always do that, but it's amazing what can happen. I had a fellow come to me with high blood pressure. I had to put a different diagnosis code, but anyways, I did some craniosacral, and we were able to, and with medication too, but get his blood pressure down because it was dangerous to within normal limits, and it stayed that way. So sometimes by freeing up the body, and again, there's that psychophysical mechanism, it's amazing what can be done. But you can't fix everything. You got to be real too. And here's what I say to patients sometimes. They'll ask me, they want to know instantly what, and sometimes I say, I don't know. And they're like, thank you. Everybody always tells me, this is what it is. I know. But sometimes I don't know. But I said, well, we'll figure it out. I mean, I can't come up with instant answers. Then I look and I evaluate people. And finally, like the second or third session, I go, I know what's going on here. And we can target stuff. So real, I would term authentic healing is, it's more dimensional. And I think it's more difficult because you really have to think about your patients. I have 10 or 12 patients today, and they're all unique and individuals, and there's no cookie-cutter approach. So you really have to put some mental energy and some intuition to your patients.
Yeah, so you're not looking at people like, okay, which box do I put them in so I can do this protocol treatment? You're looking at who's the individual in front of me, and what does this person actually need in this moment? And what they need next time you come into your office may not be the same thing because things have changed. So to be open enough to see what's changing, what's not changing, what you've done that's working, what you've done that hasn't worked, all those kinds of things, to be able to see those things and help a person move forward. I think it can be quite complicated, and it requires a lot more effort than just, okay, you know, check box, this person has this diagnosis, and for this diagnosis, I do this thing every single time.
I'll do a process of elimination sometimes. If somebody has, like, right hand pain, I'll work on their right hand, their shoulder, and I do different things, and then sometimes you hit a home run. Oh, that's what it was. It was actually in their neck or wherever it was. So, you know, you don't have the answers exactly right there in the first session. So you have to tease it out, and you have to, through process elimination, I pick the priority list or problem list of what probably is going on, and then I go down that list in my head. They don't know that I'm doing it, but I can see things that need to get done. And yeah, and every time they come in, well, sometimes I don't have that problem anymore. But now I have the other side is bothering me. It feels really tight. I don't know what happened. It's an unwinding, and everybody's got a different pattern that I have to follow to get them better. And so I have to pay attention to my patients.
Definitely. So that listening piece that you were mentioning is more than just the ears, isn't it? There's something profound that opens up just by being still and listening with all of your senses.
Yes, listening is, yeah, where does that word take you? It can be very deep and dimensional. And sometimes I'll have a patient come in, and they're here coming to me for a neck problem. And I'll automatically go for their right ankle or something. And they'll, how did you know that I twisted my ankle or whatever? And I said, actually, I didn't know. I just was drawn to your ankle, and I don't even know why. But so that intuition thing and listening can be deeper levels.
Does that include when you're doing palpation, like when you are targeting in to find an area that's bound up, or that just is there a certain way that the tissue under your fingers feels? Is there some way that you're getting information there?
Yeah, that's a good question. All the manual therapists I do, I give to osteopathic medicine, developers of these 100 years ago or more. Anyways, they would scan somebody's body with their hand, and that's what I do. I look for tissue tension, abnormal tension that shouldn't be there. There's a problem. This tension, how deep does it go? Is it spread out? Is it like a spider web? And so I have to sense what, yes. So the answer is yes, with your hands. And the more you do this stuff, you become more and more sensitive with your hands, and they are able to pick up stuff. And so, yeah, with a knee problem you're talking about, sometimes you're working on a knee, you can sense there's a muscle in front, we call the rectus femoris, I can't think of different terms, but that I can sense it. It's really tight, that leads up into their hip, and so I start to follow that pattern, and yes, with my hands.
So what you're doing, it sounds like you're really working like an osteopath might have worked 100 years ago, because osteopaths don't really work that way anymore, do they? So these techniques which would go under osteopathy are kind of living in the physical in the manual physical therapy world now. So you wouldn't necessarily go to an osteopath and expect that kind of treatment unless somebody's really trained with with somebody who's been doing old school osteopathy.
Yeah, the few osteopaths who do manual therapies, they do more grade 5 manipulation, like a chiropractor kind of thing, and so I don't do that type of thing. So yes, actually physical therapy has taken over more the manual therapy, some osteopathy, but actually a small percentage of PTs do this kind of work because it requires patience, meditation, and listening. And so if you just want if PT just wants to throw somebody an exercise bike and that's what they want to do, that's fine. But the form I do is a one-on-one therapy and focusing on the patient to actually get them better. What a concept.
And educating them the whole way.
Correct.
Yeah. So what other things are you looking at? Are you looking at diet? Are you looking at lifestyle? Are you looking at what their average day is like? Like what other kinds of things are you looking at? Are you just really treating the physical person who's here right now, or are you actually looking at all other aspects of their life? Are you bringing that into the treatment as well?
Yeah, from a nutritional standpoint, I send them off to more of a expert who knows more about that. Unless I'm working on a woman who's getting a cramp in her liver area, and I'm telling her that she's got a fatty liver or something, and she goes off that weekend, has French fries, and comes back and said, I ate French fries, and immediately I had that major cramp in my ribs. And so it's kind of a no-brainer you need to stay away from greasy, fatty foods. Yeah. Your problem with your liver, it needs to be cleansed. And so so from a nutritional standpoint, I kind of send people out. But basically, I will have people look at some of their situations. A lot of times, people are are painted back into a corner, and they're stressed. And so I'll treat a patient. They have symptoms in their body. And then as they work through, name it, a divorce, whatever is going on, as that is gone and resolved, their symptoms start to really go away quick. So a lot of times it's stressors in life also as holding patterns in people's bodies.
So it's interesting because that's one of the things that we see, and I know cranial sacral therapists talk about it, that if the person comes in and they're really locked in that fight or flight mode, adrenal stress, that it's going to be hard to get them into the place where they're receptive to healing. So we have some ways that we can get help the person get into that state. We use some particular needles on the ears that affect the nervous system and help flip that nervous system state. We also teach a breathing technique called the 478 breathing. It comes from Mercola.com that we teach all the time, and that helps the person do it on their own. So are there things that you use when you see that somebody's really locked into that fight or flight mode, so, you know, just to help them get into a state of mind where the therapy's going to work better?
When someone comes in, I can tell they're like a cat on a hot tin roof. They're just wired and stressed or whatever it is. I will lay, especially in the wintertime, put blankets around them. I'll go right to their cranial region and start doing cranial sacral. And it's almost as if you hit what's called a still point in somebody, and they almost can't help it. Their eyes start to nod, and they're closed, and they go off into a deep trance-like therapeutic sleep. Mm-hmm. And they are revived. So craniosacral can be used to calm the whole body when needed. It's very subtle kind of energy. It's different than the other manual therapies.
And can you say a little bit more about what cranial sacral is? And that again came from an osteopath. From osteopathic lineage?
Dr. Sutherland was the originator of cranial sacral therapies, and I've been with his lineage.
So and that's as opposed to the Upledger?
Yes.
Technique. So there are two main ones, right?
Right.
Sutherland and Upledger.
And Upledger, I've never had a course, but it's more regimented, 1 through 10 kind of thing. Sutherland is more intuitive. But it's kind of hard to put into words. Craniosacral is a very subtle energy around. We have a craniosacral pulse in our cerebral spinal fluid that goes down our spine. And there's two gates at C2 and S1, or S2. And you change the rhythm of that pattern. Sometimes it's irregular. It's like a wave situation. And you calm their tide almost. It's like a tide pattern.
This is physical, physical gait and physical flow of fluids?
Well, it's physical in my hands. Mm-hmm. When I did it 10 years ago, I thought I was imagining things. But then once I really got into it, it's very, really physical. And once that you reach that homeostasis or that symmetry in the body in the wave-like action becomes very therapeutic and rhythmic. People come completely relaxed.
So what is there an explanation for that? I mean, I'm thinking in terms of the cerebral spinal fluid, like it's nourishing, you know, it's nourishing the spinal cord and the nervous system. But how could you explain how that works when that pattern sort of changes how it relaxes people? What is it actually doing?
Well, I think the rhythm almost gets a hiccup in it, so to speak, and it stays that way. They're a little bit off all the time. And babies that are born or pulled, well, sometimes they'll cry for months after they're born. Their cranial sacral rhythm is off. So with working on human on adults, it's you can change the relaxing pattern within the cranium. Allows the fluid to flow more freely, but really, it's the rhythm. You get that rhythm back. It's gentle, almost like a rocking. And that, what did grandma's do in a rocking chair? Mm-hmm. That rocking action is actually a cranial sacral kind of rhythm, kind of thing. So, bringing them back to their center.
So you could say that's really a natural state, right? That's really the natural state that the body probably wants to actually come back into. And it's the either stress patterns or postural patterns or maybe even an injury or something like that that disrupts it. But if you find just the right subtle manipulation, the body jumps at the opportunity to just come back to that still point. Is that the idea?
It's the idea. I don't call it manipulation because I'm a facilitator. It does it on its own. I'm not manipulating anything. And I can sense where these things need to change, and so it's really hard to put into words because it's like a living thing. That's kind of like the Alexander technique too, but it's very therapeutic and it's very real.
I had an experience with cranial sacral therapy years ago when my mother was a registered nurse, and she was doing this classes with Upledger to just do this as a little support. And her hospital she was working in, Eastern Maine Medical Center, was very progressive and encouraged her to do this. And anyway, she treated me after an automobile injury. And at the time, I was in the sciences, university degree and pre-medical studies, basically. And I was very skeptical of what she was doing. And she treated me, and it actually shocked me. I was shocked.
But you actually experienced the accident on the table.
Something quite extraordinary happened. I got on her treatment table. I lied down, and I said, oh, okay, go ahead, Mom. I'll do whatever you're going to do. I'll just take a nap or something. Well, anyway, I relaxed pretty deeply, as you're describing. And all of a sudden, where her hands were, I felt a lot of heat. And spontaneously, without any effort on my part, my body lurched up. And then fell back down onto the table and then lurched up again. And it was actually the exact kind of motion from the initial trauma of the automobile accident. So I was hit from behind and my body was thrown forward in just that fashion. And then the automobile was struck a second time as the driver had hit me again trying to get away. And so it created this double trauma and a lot of pain that wasn't healing in my neck and shoulders. And she did this treatment, and literally my body did this thing. And it was very bizarre. And I really wasn't consciously moving, deliberately moving it. Just my body did this. And then after she finished, I slept for hours and hours. And the next day, the pain had gone down so dramatically. And I could say that maybe the true healing started after that point.
A mechanism of injury. If someone's in a car accident or has an injury, you actually, I've learned so much from osteopathic medicine. You take them back into positioning. That's what strain counter strain or positional release. You take them back into positions where they had the injury. They have to, I don't know why, but sometimes relive some of these accidents to heal and to release and let it go. So you had a true unwinding with your mom.
Very mysterious process.
That's why some of these things are kind of hard to talk about and put into words, because everybody will have a different experience with craniosacral. And some people go into unwinding. Some people go into a deep sleep. Some people see colors. Some people, everybody's different. So, and actually, it's very personal, too. So with me and that patient who stays in that room, kind of what went on with them. So, but that's how you develop trust with people.
Yeah.
But something else, I've gone off the subject a little bit. But here's an interesting concept. Someone has chronic pain, weeks, month, year, years. Pain is an energy drainer. It steals energy from you. Just say you or I are able to release, some people start to amp their pain down, gets less and less, to the point they're actually pain-free. Well, unless they're a very strong soul, they're going to be chronically somewhat maybe in a bad mood, or don't treat their wife or husband or dog or kids or whatever it is, because they're in chronic pain. It's just, it works on your emotions. As they become freed up, they're happier. This is very simplistic, but it's very true. And they start to treat their family or friends, I've seen it, with more respect and more happiness, and it spreads. And it sounds quite altruistic, but I think it's a real thing.
It's kind of holographic, whatever. If you've got somebody coming in and their body is in tension and they're kind of tight and their shoulders are rolled in and they're clenching their teeth and they're not really breathing. I mean, what kind of person are you going to be interacting with versus somebody who's really open and everything's free flowing? Like, it's going to affect their personality. It's going to affect their interpersonal relationships. I mean, how can it not? It's funny that we assume that it shouldn't, but it does. Absolutely.
And one of the things in life is to actualize your potential. And as people become more self-actualized, they're happier. I can't think of a better word right now. And so it just spreads. I love that idea.
Yeah.
There's a body posture I'll put people in when they're, and it's really, really clear the difference in about 10 seconds. When somebody comes in and they're kind of down and depressed, often I'll say, okay, stand with your feet on the floor, put your arms over your head, and look up at the ceiling. And just stand there for about 10 seconds. And invariably, people start to smile.
But like, we should all do it right now.
Okay.
Okay, a glow is starting to form over the Turkey Red building here.
Right, it's just something about that posture. It's actually the anatomical position in Chinese medicine. It represents man standing between heaven and earth, perfectly balanced between yin and yang. But there's something about that posture, and I think it shows people how quickly just changing one little thing is like changing how they breathe or changing how they're standing can change everything. It's like, oh, well, whatever was bothering me isn't so bad. You know, it takes that tight self-focus and that away for just a moment, and they get to experience something different.
Well, and hopefully, you know, people come to you and to me to change. My brother is a renowned Alexander Technique teacher, and you start moving people out of certain postures that they've been stuck into for years. Some people don't want to change, and they want to go back into certain postures, which is fine. We have freedom to do whatever we want to, but change is just what you're saying. By just simple reaching overhead and looking up, they have to want to change, and once they realize what it feels like, then it should just go on into infinity from there.
Now that's great. I love that you said infinity, because I really feel like that is the calling. Maybe at a deep level, there is this sort of this reaching out. I think, and it's part of a deep seed, I think, in the human capacity is to reach out for what yet has not happened, what else is possible. And if we can get a little bit outside of our patterns, our habits, the impulse to reach ahead, to see what else is possible from here, I feel like that's really a core part of the healing process. If in some way we can release that possibility.
Well, people ask me, how did you end up coming up with the infinity physical therapy? And I was at PT school, and some people might have a problem with this, but I didn't come up with it. It came to me, and it was not for me. It literally came to me of what, and I almost had somewhat of a vision I was going to run a PT place, but infinity physical, and the more I thought about infinity, it just started to explode in a good way. It felt good. And the name, just the name itself, and just the idea of the infinity is such a powerful, powerful term.
So there's no limits.
No limits.
Yeah.
So let's talk about change. How do you help people change? What's your key to open up that for folks to help them?
Well, just as Sam had mentioned, just a simple reaching overhead, you can get change in people by start to change their physical pattern. Oh, that feels better now. Great. And so by them changing their body, their emotions, and their mindset, and they're more positive about getting better, they have to change. I can help them to change physically, but it should start to unwind, and it should be a natural process for them. They're coming to you for a reason, is to change for the better. And so really it starts on a physical level, but it also can't. So I say words are so powerful. When I see something, it's like, no, you don't have a problem. We're going to get you better. The smile on somebody's face, they know that I can help them get them better. So change also comes through words and through positive feedback towards somebody.
And since we're talking about change, one of the things I know that can make a huge difference is exercise. And so for some people, that's great. Some people love to exercise. They love to move their bodies. For other people, that's almost a little bit too much just to think about exercise. So I want to just talk about what your approach is to the idea of exercise. We're an interesting culture in that we think that if a little is good, a lot must be better. So we have a lot of people that Kevin and I would term, you know, unhealthy fit people who are overdoing it in terms of exercise, and they're actually harming themselves. There's been some studies that came out in the past couple of weeks about people who run excessive amounts, you know, over 50 to 100 miles per week, in some ways maybe harming their heart. In Chinese medicine, we would say they're actually depleting their heart energy, that you can actually over-exercise. Like, we don't really have that kind of ingrained in our culture yet. People think that if a little is good, I might as well just do as much as they possibly can, and that's not necessarily a definition of fitness. So I would love to hear what your thoughts are in terms of exercise, and just coming back to the fact that our body was designed for movement. And so one of the big causes of illness is people not moving their bodies or not moving their bodies enough or appropriately. So what would you say about that?
Well, I ran for years, so I'm talking about myself. Anytime somebody runs, five times your body weight lands on that limb, on your heel strike, then that translates up your body. So whatever I weigh, whatever a person weighs, times that by five, that's a lot of poundage going into your body. So, and then excessive runners, it's just a formula for there's going to be dysfunction coming up. I have people exercise. I ask them what they are going to exercise. I can show them a program with TheraBall for core stability. I can take them to a weight room. Well, when I do, it's not like a football hockey player mentality with lifting weights. It's very conscious, slow, and controlled. And I actually take pulley systems and I actually do stretches with pulleys and do a form a Tai Chi. And so I actually use, me personally, weightlifting. I don't even call it weightlifting, but I don't know what else to call it. I use it as a meditation. And it doesn't take very long. I got to peak fitness late this morning. I was there for 20 minutes, but within 20 minutes' time, I got so much done. Every body part got worked. So a basic movement and strengthening. This body needs some stressors into the joints, actually, with my wrists and my elbows. Actually, the more I work out in a conscious way, the less I have musculoskeletal problems. I went on vacation. I was gone for 2 weeks. My joints began to hurt. I hadn't worked out in 2 weeks. So doing exercise, and yes, it can be overdone and done wrong by people throwing weights and doing silly things. So, we need to move. It depends. What do you like to do? If somebody's cross-country skiing, I'm not going to lift weights. I ask them what they want because I say it's a waste of your time and money for me to show you a TheraBall exercise program. You're not going to do it? Well, then I'm not going to show you. I mean, I'll show them certain things so they get better, but they just tell me, I'm not going to exercise after I'm through. So, well, that's fine, too, without judgment. But so human movement, whether it's Tai Chi, gentle lifting weights, and also age-appropriate, because when we were 20-year-old, you know, we're in great shape and could do anything, but as we go to get older, you have to be smarter about kind of what you do and how you do it. So, from I don't know about Chinese standpoint, but human movement, getting the blood flowing, new neurologic information to your whole body. Again, here's that psychophysical mechanism again. Your brain, it actually, and your heart gets pumping. It sends more blood to your brain, so it actually makes you smarter.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
Exercise makes you smarter. You heard that here.
Absolutely. Now we were coming down to the last few minutes here of the show.
There's a couple things I want to talk about.
Yeah. Maybe I'll just do it really quickly. You know, the population is aging. You have baby boomers who are very active, and you're starting to see a lot of knee replacements. You're seeing hip replacements, and we're also seeing a lot of early onset Alzheimer's. And so we're starting to see some peculiar trends in healthcare, chronic illness, and that sort of thing. And I'm wondering, because there's a neurological component to the work you do, there's a lot of stress that factors into the health and well-being of people in the population. Do you have any thoughts about, in this particular age bracket, the folks that are 50, 60, 70s, what can they do to maintain their health?
Well, walking done the right way is just simple walking is very excellent to do. The problem is we're in Alaska, it's icy and black ice, so to be able to walk freely is really important. One thing, total hip replacements in India are rare because they sit in a lotus position. They lubricate their joints so Americans don't internally, externally rotate their femurs. And so after a while, they begin to wear down and they need a total. So Tai Chi, gentle but consistent exercise.
Okay, I guess we're down to the last minute of this show.
My question was going to be about core strength. So if there's anything you want to say about that for in 20 seconds.
And then also finish up with how folks can follow up.
Yeah, let us know where you're located, what your phone number is, and if they want to call you so make an appointment.
Well, core stability can be us right now in sitting. We can consciously, isometrically contract our rectus, our abdominis, and anyways. So you can actually create core by lifting up a coffee cup. So it can be a conscious thing. Now, obviously, there's exercises and things you can do. I'm located at 342 South Alaska Street, 746-7874. Call me from 9 to 6 or whatever it is, and if needed, I can help you out.
Great. Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Joe Brenner. And you can hear a rebroadcast of this show this coming Wednesday at 5 p.m. here on Radio Free Palmer. Thanks a lot, everyone.
Have a good night,
Thanks
everybody.
For joining us.
Thank
good
you.
Night.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links and resources from our guests and show topics.